Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
The First Amendment to the United States Constitution states, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances." When it comes to matters of religion and politics, or church and state, most of the debate centers around the first two portions of that amendment, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. But what about freedom of speech? Should that be included in our discussion of religion and politics? Specifically, do clergy have the constitutional right to speak out from the pulpit regarding political issues, parties, and candidates? Can priests and pastors, rabbis and imams, advocate certain policy positions when sermonizing? Or does the tax-exempt status of religious organizations expressly prohibit this? To investigate this issue, I am joined today by Eric Stanley, a lawyer with the Alliance Defense Fund, an organization committed to litigating issues of religious freedom, sanctity of life, and marriage and the family. They are also sponsors of the Pulpit Initiative, an effort to enhance the free speech rights of clergy. Eric, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, hi, thanks for having me on today.
Now, just so our listeners know, the Research on Religion podcast series is primarily devoted to interviews with scholars who study religion from a social scientific perspective. But from time to time, we like to engage what I call practitioners, people who are involved in the day-to-day operations of religious or related organizations. These are the people who we, as scholars, study, after all, and it's good to get their perspective on things. And that is the purpose today of having Eric Stanley of the Alliance Defense Fund here. We want to talk about this issue of religious free speech, where it has been, where it is today, and where it's going, specifically with relation to the Pulpit Initiative, and we might find a few different directions to go from there as well. But before launching into this subject, Eric, could you give us a bit of background on the Alliance Defense Fund, what it is, and what do you folks do?
Well, absolutely. It'd be my pleasure. The Alliance Defense Fund is a legal alliance, and our mission is to defend the right to hear and speak the truth. And what we were organized by a group of Christian leaders back in the 80s, and a group of Christian leaders that really saw a need for a legal organization to really stand up and combat a lot of the attacks on the free exercise and the free speech rights of churches and pastors and people of faith. And so what we do is we practice in the three areas that you mentioned, the sanctity of human life, the traditional family, and religious freedom. And we do that in different ways. We, of course, litigate cases when that's necessary. We engage actively in training. As of today, we've trained over 1,600 allied attorneys across the country to do religious freedom litigation.
Now, these are lawyers who already have their law degrees, or is there any outreach to law schools?
That's correct. Our 1,600 allied attorneys are lawyers that already have their law degree. There is an outreach to law schools through what's called our Blackstone Legal Fellowship, where we train law students and provide a fellowship program where they can actually engage in some of these areas during the summer. And we've trained hundreds of law students through that program through the years. We also engage in strategy with the allied organizations that we're allied with. And then we fund cases. We fund the cases that fall within our primary mission and within those three areas that we deal with. So that's really what the Alliance Defense Fund's about and how we've been organized.
Well, that's great. We'll once we get our website up and running, we'll post a link to the Alliance Defense Fund, and I'm sure a number of students listening might be interested in that Blackstone Fellowship as well. Let's now talk to – well, what is your – area of expertise? I know there's a number of lawyers, and you, the Alliance Defense Fund is principally located in Arizona, but you operate out of Kansas City office, that's correct?
That's right. We have different, what we call regional service centers throughout the country, and I'm located in the Kansas City office. My area of expertise really falls within what we call the Alliance Defense Fund's Church Project. And while I've litigated religious liberty issues for years, everything from church zoning issues to Ten Commandments and public buildings and a number of different issues like that, right now what I'm focusing on are the constitutional rights of pastors and churches, and specifically combating many of the attacks that churches are undergoing these days in different contexts. And so that's our focus, and my area of expertise is related specifically over the last couple of years to heading up ADF's pulpit initiative, which you mentioned,
right?
Which I know we're going to talk more about, but that's really been my focus over the last couple of years.
Well, let's start talking about that. Let's talk about the pulpit initiative and the related Pulpit Freedom Sunday, which I believe was held first in September of 2008. Give us an idea what the pulpit initiative is about and what the Pulpit Freedom Sunday was all about.
Sure. The Pulpit Initiative is, to put it simply, a head-on constitutional attack against the Johnson Amendment, which is the tax exemption rules and regulations that relate to nonprofit organizations. And specifically, what we want to do is to attack the authority of the IRS or any other government agency to censor what a pastor can and cannot say from the pulpit. And so the Pulpit Initiative is specifically limited to a constitutional challenge related to a pastor's speech from the pulpit to his church and to his congregation. And Pulpit Freedom Sunday is a part of that. It's a way of putting some legs to the Pulpit Initiative, where in September of 2008 we had pastors who preached a sermon on Pulpit Freedom Sunday altogether. And their sermon evaluated the current candidates for office in light of Scripture and Scripture's teachings, and then made specific recommendations as to how their congregation should vote based upon that evaluation.
So what these pastors were actually doing was naming candidates. It wasn't anything vague, but it was McCain or Obama.
That's correct. Yeah, they were talking specifically about the candidates and the positions that those candidates espoused, and whether those positions align with scriptural truth as that church viewed it, and then going the step further of telling the congregation this is how you should exercise your right to vote, either for or against the specific named candidate. And then what those pastors did is they took a recording of their sermon and they sent it to the IRS and specifically asked the IRS to investigate and audit the church. And the sole purpose of that is to hopefully foment litigation over this issue, where the federal court will have the opportunity to review the constitutionality of the Johnson Amendment.
Well, before we find out what actually came of this, Freedom Sunday, Pulpit Freedom Sunday, let's find out a little bit more about this. The initial Pulpit Freedom Sunday, as we mentioned, was in September of 2008. How many churches, pastors, did you get participating in this?
Well, the first Pulpit Freedom Sunday in September 2008, we had 33 pastors from 22 different states that participated. Last year, Pulpit Freedom Sunday in 2009, we had about 84 pastors and churches that participated in 30 different states in the District of Columbia. This year, we're hoping to be on track for well over 200 that would participate this year.
Wow, amazing. And so that's in the works. That's coming in September of 2010.
It is. The Pulpit Freedom Sunday of this year will be September 26th of 2010. And yeah, that's definitely in the works. And we're actively talking to pastors and churches at this point that are interested in participating with us on this.
Now, what is the range of churches and pastors that are participating in this? Is it specifically one denomination? Is it across the broad range of Christian denominations? Do you have non-Christian organizations participating?
Well, it really is across the range of Christian denominations, you know, Baptist, Episcopal, Lutheran, Assemblies of God, non-denominational. You know, it really runs the gamut of Christian denominations. And, you know, that's one of the things that we've made very clear from the outset with this pulpit initiative is that this is not specifically related to any particular denomination. It's not related to whether it's a conservative denomination or a liberal denomination. It's related to the right of all pastors and all churches to speak out freely from their pulpits and not to be censored or fear government censorship or punishment if they do so. So it's been open to any church that wants to participate, Historically, for the last 2 years, we've had churches mostly of the Christian denomination participating.
Is there any particular denomination or area of the country that this seems to resonate with more than others?
You know, not really. It's been very interesting. As I said, the first year we had about 22 different states represented from across the country, and everywhere from Washington State to Florida to Wyoming to up in the Northeast and in the middle of the country. I mean, it's been all over. Last year, we broadened that out to about 31 states and the District of Columbia. So it has a broad regional appeal and is something that, as we've seen it grow over the last 2 years and as we're seeing it grow again this year, is something that I think pastors across the country are concerned about. So it's not really related to a specific region. And really, it's not related to a specific denomination either. We've heard from multi-denominations that this is something that pastors and churches are concerned about and want to have taken care of.
This is great. This is one of the services we try to provide with the Research on Religion podcast, is not only highlighting research, but giving ideas for other research projects. There might be some graduate students or other scholars out there listening to this podcast, and this seems like a great area of study to figure out, you know, who is participating, why they're participating, the diversity of the participation, I think, cries out for explanation as well. So for scholars out there studying this, it would be really interesting to, follow this as it moves along.
Yeah, before, absolutely. And in fact, it's been both conservative and liberal churches as well.
That makes it all the more interesting. I noticed that you had mentioned Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. is not noted for, you know, conservative churches the way that you might think Mississippi might be. So that's absolutely fascinating, because I think this issue of free speech is not just one for one side of the political spectrum, but one that cuts across all political stripes. Let me, if I can, before we find out again what has happened after the first Pulpit Freedom Sunday, I want to take us back in history. You'd mentioned the Lyndon Baines Johnson Amendment back in 1954. Anybody even take it a little bit farther than that, thinking about American history here? Have clergy had a history of speaking out on social and political issues from the pulpit, say, dating back to colonial times?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think there's any question that the church has really been at the forefront of many of the great social and moral movements of our day. In fact, historians have said that the moral force for independence during colonial times was the pulpit. Stories abound of pastors that were specifically involved in the fight for independence. Pastor Muhlenberg being the famous one of removing his black clerical robe and showing the militia uniform and leading out 300 men from his church to go and fight for independence. And so pastors have always spoken out on the great social and moral issues of our day, ending child labor, promoting women's suffrage. Pastors and churches were really at the forefront of the civil rights movement.
Right.
And if you go back in terms of narrowing it down even a little bit more, there is a specific heritage in history of pastors speaking out even on candidates and elections, even going so far back as the election of Thomas Jefferson. There are sermons from pastors that we have in black and white that, again, is another interesting research project, but is something that has not been widely reported, but where pastors, when the need has arisen in their minds, have spoken freely about candidates for office and have urged their congregation to either vote for or against specific candidates. I mentioned the election of Thomas Jefferson. There's specific examples of when Abraham Lincoln was running, pastors that were supporting his candidacy from the pulpit.
Right.
There were even up until the election that Al Wilson was running, there was kind of the Catholic component of that election, and there were pastors that were speaking out about that particular election. So really up until the mid-1950s, when the Johnson Amendment was enacted, we see these examples in history of pastors, when they feel compelled to do so, speaking out from the pulpit, either in support of or in opposition to candidates.
And that's important to remember here, because, for the past 50 or 60 years, we've had this image that, pastors have to be silent when it comes to the issues of candidates. And again, that goes back to the Johnson Amendment that you're talking about. This was in 1954. Give us some background on what occurs with Lyndon Baines Johnson in 1954 and what kind of impact that has had on the free speech of pastors since then.
Sure. Yeah, you know, it's really a fascinating story, and it's one that folks that were alive during the Johnson era would remember. Johnson in 1954 was running to re-election for the U.S. Senate seat for the state of Texas, and he was faced in his election bid by a man who was a state senator in Texas by the name of Dudley Dougherty. Johnson referred to him as the young man from Beeville. He was a 31-year-old state senator, and you know, that may not be seen as much of a challenge to Johnson, but what happened at the time were two very powerful private secular nonprofit organizations, FACTS Forum and the Committee for Constitutional Government were their names. One was run by the oil billionaire in Texas, H.L. Hunt. The other was run by the famous publisher, Frank Gannett.
Mm-hmm.
And those two men really saw Johnson as soft on communism. You know, this was back in the day of McCarthyism and the battle against communism, and they saw him as soft on communism, and so they started really distributing thousands of pieces of literature in Texas that were supporting Dougherty and opposing Johnson. And, you know, Johnson believed that this was really hurting his reelection chances and tried to find some ways to deal with this. Went to the Texas Elections Commission and, you know, to try to find out if these nonprofits were violating any laws, and found out they weren't, and even went to the IRS. And the IRS said, no, they're not violating any laws. And so the next thing that happens is July 2nd, 1954, Johnson showed up on the floor of the U.S. Senate, and he offered an amendment to an existing tax overhaul bill that was currently pending before the Senate. And the legislative history on the amendment is exceedingly brief. It's only about two paragraphs long in the congressional record. And it shows that Johnson stands up and he offers this amendment, which we now know as Section 501c3 of the tax code.
Right.
And he makes the statement that the amendment has been agreed to by the sponsor of the current pending bill, and a voice vote was called for, and the amendment was added and passed unanimously. And so there really wasn't any debate or analysis, no committee hearings, no, you know, legislative reports done on this. And suddenly the tax code was changed so that nonprofit organizations could not speak out in support of or in opposition to candidates for office.
It's quite amazing when you think of it. It's just slipped in under the, you know, at the last minute and a voice vote on this, but it has had such a huge impact on free speech of 501c3s, and specifically as we're talking here, religious groups, that that is just quite amazing.
Well, it really is, and you know, whether it was intended or not to encompass churches, and you know, there is some evidence. George Reedy was a man who was Johnson's chief legislative aide at the time this was passed, and in an interview with one author of a law review article, he is quoted as saying that Johnson never intended for this to apply to churches.
Hmm.
But whether intended or not, it certainly has applied to churches. And what we have now is really a generation of churchgoers, of pastors and churches who have grown up with the idea that it is illegal for a pastor or a church to do anything that would support or oppose a candidate for office, when in fact, if you go back and you look at the beginnings of the Johnson Amendment, there really is no valid justification for why the amendment was passed in the first place.
Right.
So it really kind of begs the question of, well, if we've grown up with this idea, why is this like this? And if you look at it and the attendant effects that it has on the constitutional rights of pastors and churches, you can really start to understand that there's some real constitutional problems with the Johnson Amendment itself.
It's interesting. This thing has taken on a life of its own, and I mean, most of my students, and I just recently gave a talk down at Baylor University where, you know, students said, well, churches are tax-exempt, therefore they cannot speak out about politics on the pulpit, not even specifically about candidates, but it's broadened to any type of political issue, and you can imagine how, you know, broadening that definition of what they can speak out will have a chilling effect on them.
It does, and I do think, too, that the IRS has had a lot to do with that in terms of how the IRS has enforced the Johnson Amendment through the years. If you look at the guidance that the IRS has issued over the years, they've gone so far as to say that churches cannot be directly or indirectly involved in a campaign, and there's no guidance as to what indirectly involved means. They've said that they won't tell you in advance what type of conduct is unlawful under the Johnson Amendment, they'll say they have to look at all the facts and circumstances. They call it the facts and circumstances test to determine if the law is violated. And then in 1993, they even went so far as to say that you could violate the Johnson Amendment by not even mentioning a candidate by name, but using what they call code words.
Wow.
Just saying either, you know, pro-life or pro-abortion, that in and of itself, if that's a defining issue in the campaign, would violate the Johnson Amendment. And so you couple the Johnson Amendment with these really kind of increasingly vague guidance from the IRS over the last 50 or so years, and you really have a chilling effect on speech that's very pervasive.
And what's surprising about this, too, is that the enforcement comes from the IRS, and that this becomes essentially a tax issue. And that's one of the questions I want to explore here. Where does the tax-exempt status of churches originate from?
Well, you know, that's really interesting because as far back as we've ever been able to go in American history, churches have always been tax-exempt. There has never been a time in American history where churches were not tax-exempt. Now, you might be able to point to a couple of instances in colonial history where churches, you know, non-recognized churches have been taxed.
Right.
But for the most part, you know, from the time of our Constitution forward, churches have always been tax-exempt. It's been assumed, it's been adopted in every iteration of the tax code from the first one all the way up through today. And there have been scholars that have gone back and even looked even as far back as ancient Sumeria to find that churches have been tax-exempt even far back to there.
Wow.
And there's different justifications for it, but I think that it really boils down to the idea that the church has really, you know, a separate kind of sovereignty feel to it that, you know, the government just doesn't want to intrude upon. And, you know, to couch it in kind of language that the Supreme Court has used today or in years past, that, you know, the power to tax does involve the power to destroy.
Right.
And there's no surer way to destroy the free exercise of religion than to begin to tax it out of existence. And so when the government imposes those taxes on the church, it is asserting that sovereignty and control over the church. If the church refuses to comply, the government can really shut down a particular church or a particular religion.
As many,
the coercive power of the tax code.
Absolutely. As many churches oftentimes operate on a shoestring budget, any type of additional expenditures that they face could have a very harmful effect on them. But let me challenge you a little bit on this tax-exempt status and try to explore what this means, because, you know, our church is really completely tax exempt. I have run across a number of churches that I'll talk to the pastors, and they pay different types of property taxes based upon whether their property has religious use or not. There are some states that have exemptions that say you're not taxed on your property up to the first 5 acres. Then after that, it's you know, he hits another instance of the tax code. And then, of course, there's always the issue of, well, you have employees on the church staff. They're going to pay payroll taxes, the FICA, et cetera, et cetera. So what are we talking about when we say tax exempt?
Well, I do think that there are instances where churches are taxed. In fact, another example would be that there are a lot of churches that or some states where churches have to pay sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the goods that they buy. Some states have sales tax exemptions for churches, but others don't. And so there are instances where churches are taxed. And I do think, though, the broad pervasive idea, and the one that seems to be the most you know, pervasive as a whole, if you kind of look at it without the exceptions, would be that churches as a whole are not taxed. And there are good reasons for that.
Right.
In fact, you know, as the Supreme Court said in the Waltz case,
mm-hmm.
we're talking about the constitutionality of property tax exemptions for churches, and they did hold that a property tax exemption for a church was constitutional. And the court noted there that, well, there would be less issue with taxation or with under the Constitution, under specifically excessive entanglement of the government with religion, there would be less excessive entanglement by simply providing an exemption for churches than there would be with government trying to tax the church as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that while there might be some exceptions, I think as a whole, there really is a societal and really a cultural idea that's been enshrined in the law that the church is just not an appropriate type of entity to be taxed by the government.
Again, another interesting topic for a research project. Actually, it's one that I'm very interested in since I do research on religion and property rights. But let's bring this up to the present now. So we're talking about churches that largely have a tax-exempt status. They qualify as 501c3s. And this has created the aura that from the pulpit, they are not allowed to speak politically, specifically of various candidates. What about what other 501c3 organizations? I mean, you could think of the Sierra Club. You know, Sierra Club has a lot of political workings that they engage in. And so what's the difference between them and, say, secular institutions?
Well, I think it does kind of beg the question about whether it's legitimate as a whole for nonprofits to be told and to be compelled that they cannot speak out on political issues, or risk losing their tax exemption. And I don't think I haven't seen a valid justification for that, as a whole with nonprofits anyway.
Right.
And I'll just note in passing that, I wonder where the Supreme Court of the United States is going with this idea after the Citizens United case, which mm-hmm. had some extremely broad language about the free speech rights of nonprofits to engage in specifically political speech. It was a very broad opinion, one that was extremely strong on free speech rights of specifically nonprofit organizations. So, the idea that a nonprofit as a whole shouldn't be speaking out, I'm not sure there's a valid justification there, but yet, if you look at it in the context of, sure, the Johnson Amendment is there, nonprofits are specifically prohibited from doing anything that would support or oppose a candidate. Where I think it comes in with the pulpit initiative, which is a little bit different, is and where I think churches specifically are different than other nonprofits, is related to a pastor's sermon from the pulpit.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court has noted in the past that if a nonprofit wants to speak out on political issues, they could create a separate PAC and go and do that. That's simply just not an available option for churches when you're talking about what a pastor says from the pulpit on a Sunday morning.
Right.
It would be very, for the pastor to stand up on a Sunday morning and say, okay, we're going to conclude the service now, but we urge you all to go down the street to the local fellowship hall and, we're going to constitute the First Baptist Church PAC meeting.
Right.
Where we're going to talk about candidates. It's just not, it doesn't carry the same moral force, the same spiritual instruction, the same type of feeling that a pastor speaking from the pulpit itself would carry. You can't duplicate that. And so that's where I think, in specifically, what a pastor says from the pulpit would differ from a nonprofit generally speaking out on political issues.
That's true. It would change, if they had to create a separate PAC, it would change the whole institutional nature of the church. And I mean, this is one thing that I know the Sierra Club and other organizations avail themselves of, is that they have a 501c3 status, but then also create a PAC from which they speak. Could you, you mentioned the Citizens United case, and for those listeners who are not familiar with that, could you give a little bit background on that?
Sure, yeah, it was a case that just came out this term from the U.S. Supreme Court. It was Citizens United versus Federal Elections Commission, and it was a case that related to group Citizens United had created a movie. It was called Hillary the Movie, and
right.
it specifically talked about Hillary Clinton. And had some a lot of statements in there that would be seen as opposing any candidacy that she might have for future office. And Citizens United wanted to run some specific trailers for the movie, but the Federal Elections Commission, it ran afoul of some procedures or some rules in the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. And so the Supreme Court took up the issue, and in a very broad opinion, talking very strongly about the speech of nonprofits as specifically related to political speech, and the court talked about theoretically how in our political theory and how we operate as a country, how political speech is really at the core and how that should not be infringed upon. They struck down those Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act restrictions. And specifically said that Citizens United could go and have its trailer and speak out on those particular issues. So
right.
it was an interesting opinion, and one that I think may signify, just by the broadness of the court's language, a real acceptance by the court maybe to to look at more in-depth restrictions on political speech. At one section of the opinion, the court went through different restrictions on political speech, all the way from an outright prohibition beforehand, all the way down to, you know, fining and some fines that might be levied after the fact. And the court said all of those are impermissible prohibitions mm-hmm. on political speech of nonprofits. So that case may signify a willingness of the court to look more in depth at these things and to really look sideways at any type of attempt to squelch the political speech of nonprofit organizations as a whole. And I think it signifies a real victory for what we're doing with the Pulpit Initiative, because I think the ground is even stronger in the Pulpit Initiative context than it would be for nonprofits as a whole.
Well, let's bring it to that point right now. This is what we initially set out to talk about. So the Pulpit Initiative, give us some history about it. Who thought it up, and what was the reasoning and the logic or the strategy behind this initiative?
Well, the Pulpit Initiative was something that was really birthed out of what we have been hearing at ADF for years and years from pastors and churches. And probably the best way to explain it would be to explain kind of anecdotally, we had a couple of our attorneys who had gone to a specific conference where there were a bunch of people in attendance, and there was going to be a breakout session for pastors who were in attendance to talk about what pastors can and can't do during election time. And it was at the end of the day, and, you know, it was kind of one of the attorneys was talking about how, you know, do you really want to go and hear a couple of gray-haired attorneys go and talk about the tax code at the end of the day when everybody's tired? And you know, it's just not the most thrilling of topics. And so I wasn't expecting a big crowd. What happened was the room was packed out with pastors. And what was supposed to be a 45-minute presentation turned into an hour-and-a-half Q&A session about what pastors can and can't do. And I think what happened as a result is this attorney really came away with the idea that these are good faith people that were genuinely concerned about what they can and can't do, don't want to run afoul of the line, but yet don't understand where the line is.
Right.
And, you know, we really came to the point as an organization at ADF where we said, you know, we've been educating pastors about what they can and can't do for years and years and years. And there's still a broad chilling effect that happens with pastors. And so if we as attorneys can't educate, and if attorneys as a whole are arguing over where the line is, how can we expect our good faith pastors who really want to do what's right to know where the line is?
Right.
And so the Pulpit Initiative was really born out of a lot of that frustration of what can we do to bring some clarity to this area of the law. And the more we looked at it, the more we realized that, you know, ever since the Johnson Amendment was passed, there is no federal court has ever had the opportunity to determine whether it's constitutional for the IRS to censor a pastor's sermon.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that seemed to us to be really beyond the pale. When you're talking about a pastor's sermon from the pulpit, that ought to be sacrosanct. And so that's really where this idea came out of.
And it's interesting that the Pulpit Initiative, and specifically its manifestation in the Pulpit Freedom Sunday in 2008, it seems to be a fairly aggressive strategy. That it's not only that pastors were speaking out on that Sunday, but they recorded them and then delivered them to the IRS. So what became of this? Tell us the story from September 28th, 2008 to present. What's going on with it?
Well, what really became of it, I think, is that of the 33 pastors that participated in 2008 and of the 84 that participated last year, 33 of those pastors, only one of the original 33 ever heard from the IRS.
Hmm.
The IRS sent this pastor a letter and were opening a church investigation. And after an 11-month investigation of the church, closed the file because of what they called procedural difficulties with the instigation of the audit. And mm-hmm. what has happened now is, you know, this kind of gets into a little bit of tax issue, but the IRS must comply with the Church Audit Procedures Act, which was passed by Congress in 1984, and requires a IRS official at the level of regional commissioner or above to approve any church audits before they ever happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supposed to protect the constitutional rights of churches and pastors. What happened is in the mid-90s, the IRS reorganized from a regional organization to a practice group organization, where now you have these practice groups at the IRS, large business, small business, exempt organizations, others.
Right.
And they bumped down the official couple of levels that was approving church audits. And last January, a district court in Minnesota said that the IRS was in violation of the Church Audit Procedures Act. And so the IRS has now placed a halt on all church audits, has proposed a new regulation designating a higher-level official. And I say all of that to say that we're really in a holding pattern and a waiting pattern with the IRS.
Right.
None of these churches have heard from the IRS, but the goal of the Pulpit Initiative really is to, and the reason why it has to be so aggressive, I believe, is to bring this issue to the attention of the IRS, to make it something that the IRS cannot ignore, in order to do one of two things. Either the IRS will not act, at which point I believe the Pulpit Initiative will continue to gain momentum, and the law will de facto kind of be changed. You know, may become understood that the emperor has no clothes, really, so to speak.
Right.
Or the IRS will come against one or more of these churches, which will enable litigation on the issue.
Now, for that one church that was audited by the IRS, was there anything specific or unusual about this church? Was it public? Was it on television? Or was this just the first case that happened to go through, and then there were bureaucratic hang-ups that delayed all the other types of audits that would be occurring?
Yeah. It's very difficult to know because the IRS is so secretive about these audits, but there wasn't anything special with this church as opposed to anything else. In fact, this church, it was a small church in War Road, Minnesota, which is a very small town, about 6 miles from the Canadian border. Very small church, and, wasn't really anything special about this church. As opposed to the others that have participated in the Pulpit Initiative. And so it's difficult to figure out why the IRS went after this church as opposed to somebody else. But, the pastor was very excited that the IRS had opened an investigation and had wanted the IRS to do so.
Well, I just got to stop you there. I'd never heard the words excited IRS and audit all in the same term, but yeah, that's part of the strategy that the Pulpit Initiative is all about. So
well, it is, and I don't mean to say that he was jumping for joy, but at the same time, this pastor and all the other pastors that have participated in Pulpit Freedom Sunday just have a really strong core belief that it's not the job of the government to determine what a pastor can and can't say from the pulpit, and that even if this is something that we hear all the time, that, well, churches shouldn't participate. These pastors believe that that's an issue for pastors and churches to decide. It's not an issue for the government to mandate what side of that debate wins.
Right.
And that's what's happened with the Johnson Amendment, is that the government has placed its finger on one side of the scale of the debate over whether churches ought to speak out on candidates and elections.
Let me ask.
For 56 years now, churches have not. Because the government has mandated that they not.
Well, let me ask you this. I'm a little bit surprised that, the IRS is in a holding pattern on this right now. Again, it might be because of the way they're rearranging the bureaucracy or such. But has there been any talk of a private citizen initiating a lawsuit based upon what you folks are doing? I'm sure somebody got word of the Pulpit Initiative and said, whoa, they can't be doing that. And is that another venue that this might work its way through the courts?
Not really, because there's really no way for a private citizen to enforce or interpret the Johnson Amendment. That falls solely in the purview of the IRS.
Wow.
And this is one of the real reasons why, again, there needs to be such an aggressive strategy here, is the IRS holds all the cards when it comes to getting into court. If you look at the restrictions on churches or on tax litigation specifically, there is no way of instituting a beforehand challenge, like a facial challenge to the Johnson Amendment. You look at the Declaratory Judgment Act has a restriction on tax cases, so declaratory judgments doesn't work. And a potential injunctive act against the Johnson Amendment runs head-on into the Tax Injunction Act, which prohibits injunctions against in tax cases. And so in terms of looking at a future, you know, way of, well, why can't we just challenge this today and take the IRS to court and have it out, what has to happen with these tax cases is the IRS has to act. Mm-hmm. The IRS has to levy a penalty, and then that penalty has to be challenged in court. Congress has arranged the jurisdiction of the federal courts in such a way when it comes to tax cases as the IRS holds all the cards when it comes to court. And for 56 years now, the IRS has been very adept at keeping this issue out of court. In fact, one of the very famous cases about that was the All Saints Episcopal Church case many years ago, where they had a visiting pastor who held a mock debate between Bush and Kerry during that election with Jesus as the moderator. And at one point, the visiting pastor suggested that Bush's preemptive war strategy was a total failure.
Mm-hmm.
The IRS came after All Saints Episcopal Church, investigated them, opened an audit that went on for 27 months. All Saints Episcopal hired the former head of the exempt organizations division at the IRS, with Kaplan and Drysdale, with a big private firm in D.C.,
mm-hmm.
paid tens of thousands of dollars, you know, resisted the audit at every turn. And after 27 months, the IRS closed the file, sent the church a letter, said, you violated the law, don't do it again, but we're closing our file, and didn't give any reason why.
Wow. And that just ends the court challenge.
Yeah, you really have, the rector of the church was quoted in the L.A. Times right after that as saying that we have no more guidance now than we did 27 months ago as to what the IRS says is impermissible or not.
Has the All Saints Episcopal Church been involved in the pulpit initiative at all?
They have not.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't specifically know the reasons for that, although I do think that they would probably agree and certainly fought very hard for the right of pastors to speak freely from their pulpits. So, their case, I think, stands as an interesting beacon for what we're trying to do now,
right?
Which is to create this idea that we're in the law that pastors and churches and what happens in the pulpit is sacrosanct. The government can't censor that, can't condition tax exemption on it in any way.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me, now that we're in a holding pattern, I guess, so to speak, with the pulpit initiative, and it seems that the only way to get out of that holding pattern is that more and more churches become involved in this. And as you said, coming up here in 2010, in September 2010, there's going to be, about 200 churches are going to be involved in this?
Yeah, that's our hope this year.
Okay. And I assume that the media is going to get a hold of this sooner or later, and this will become a bigger and bigger issue that nobody can ignore. Is there a media strategy behind some of this?
Well, absolutely. In fact, we had a media strategy back in 2008, it became a really big story in 2008. Lots of stories written on it. There was op-eds. The L.A. Times did an online debate between myself and Barry Lynn from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. That debate went for a week,
mm-hmm.
Back and forth on this issue. And it really, you know, it was back in the time of the McCain-Obama election, and pastors were very much in the news,
right.
as we're all aware, with Jeremiah Wright and some of the other pastors that were involved in that election. So the issue of pastors being involved in elections of candidates is always one that's interesting, but it seemed to really hit a high note
mm-hmm.
during that election. And I think it may hit another high note again during this coming election as well.
I think that's could be expected. I had heard and read a great deal about it in 2008. I didn't know that you had another event in 2009, and in part that was an off-year election, and
right.
most of the elections are fairly local dog-catcher mayor type of elections. But 2010 looks like it's going to be a rambunctious year in the electoral spectrum, so definitely be looking to see what comes of this again. Now, you'd mentioned that you talked to Barry Lynn of the Separation for Church and State, and I just kind of take you into a little bit of a different direction here in terms of the pulpit initiative stuff. And this issue of the wall of separation that comes up frequently in church and state issues, how does this issue of wall of separation relate to the issue of the pulpit initiative and free speech rights?
Yeah, well, what's interesting about that is I don't believe that, that the wall of separation was ever intended to apply to the issue of the pulpit initiative and free speech rights. And in fact, I just to give you an idea of where I fall on that issue, I think the wall of separation is a really poor metaphor for the Establishment Clause and the relations between the state and the church.
And yet, nonetheless, what's interesting, and we have an additional podcast with Mark David Hall that we're going to talk specifically about the wall of separation, that term, wall of separation, really never started to make its way into legal cases until about the mid-20th century, right around the time of the Johnson administration.
That's right. Yeah, and they're really, you know, I think the wall of separation has kind of taken on a life of its own, and has really been applied in context where it never was intended to apply and shouldn't be applied. You know, and I think the Pulpit Initiative is one good example of that. You know, there should not be a radical separation where the church is forbidden from trying to influence the state in any way.
Right.
Now, certainly, we can all agree that there should not be any established church, that the government should never establish a church, and that the church should not try to assert its sovereignty over the state and, you know, and compel the state to do something or other. But that's, you know, those are the extreme examples. That's never happened, you know, since the birth of our Constitution.
Right.
I don't think we're anywhere close to that. But what I think the wall of separation was never intended to do was never intended to prohibit the church from trying to influence the state. But yet that seems to be how it's trying to be applied these days, not as a defensive mechanism, but as an offensive mechanism against the church to tell the church, you have no business in trying to assert your views in the political realm.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a direct infringement on free speech and the free speech rights of pastors and churches specifically.
Yeah, and one can definitely see how that works its way out. One other case I want to bring up related to this wall of separation issue and the issue of the Establishment Clause is the National Day of Prayer. And we are recording this May 3rd of 2010. This probably will not be posted on our website. We are still in the initial phases of setting up this podcast series, but we probably won't get this up and running until July of some time. But here in May, we're just a few days away from the National Day of Prayer, which has been presidents have declared a National Day of Prayer for several decades now. But recently, a federal judge in the state of Wisconsin declared that it to be unconstitutional based upon the Establishment Clause. And I was wondering if we could get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a very unfortunate decision. I think it's something that's out of step with the way the Constitution should be interpreted. I think it will hopefully go the way of those decisions from the Ninth Circuit that have declared Under God and the Pledge unconstitutional and things like that, where, you know, there's an initial furor because a one judge somewhere has taken a radical position on this issue, but that saner heads will prevail in the appellate court and will restore some sanity to constitutional interpretation. You know, there really is, it is just astounding to me that National Days of Prayer have been such a staple in American history for so many years.
Dating back to, the colonial period.
Sure. You go back all the way to the colonial period with George Washington and the Days of Prayer that he established for the troops and, you know, just on and on and on. And, you know, we've had an unbroken history of this happening over the years, and we're no closer to the establishment of a national church than we were back then.
Right.
And so I just don't see the rationale for this. I don't see what I do see is really an attempt to take the wall of separation metaphor and again use it as a sword against people of faith and to tell people of faith, well, you have no business having your views represented in any way in public, even if that's an acknowledgement by the government that we all ought to take a day and pray. So, you know, it's something I'm glad that the Obama administration has decided to appeal this case. I'm hopeful
that's
that good. The Seventh Circuit will take it and that saner heads will prevail, you know, when they look at it. But ultimately, I think if the Seventh Circuit upholds what happened in the district court, I think we'll see the Supreme Court take up that issue.
It'll be a fascinating case to
probably rule that the National Day of Prayer is constitutional.
It'll be a fascinating case to watch. And we are also a few days away here in early May from a court case on a cross in the Mojave Desert, which the Supreme Court said, hey, it's okay to have that cross there. Are we starting to see a sea change in court opinions in terms of church-state relations here? What's your opinion on that?
Well, my opinion is that I'm not real sure that we are. I'm I think that the Mojave Desert Cross case was important. I think it did come down the right way. I do think that in terms of a sea change, probably not, because if you look at the way the court's opinion came out, it was a very fractured opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the Mojave Desert Cross really won by a toenail in that particular case. But I do think what we are seeing is an attempt by the court, or an understanding by the court, to that these types of acknowledgments of religion and acknowledgments of religious heritage are appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
in life and in American society and culture. So I think there's more of an acceptance. And my read on the court as of now is I think even Justice Kennedy, who really is kind of the swing vote on these issues,
mm-hmm.
At the court, I think there's more of an acceptance with Justice Kennedy when it relates to these passive acknowledgments of religion. He really has become concerned at the efforts to remove these acknowledgments of religion, and really rightfully so. If you look at it, there's no real good stopping point. You know, when you take the Mount Soledad cross down, that's been there for 7 decades and was there to honor fallen heroes.
Right, now that's for the listeners who might not be familiar with that, that's a large cross on top of a hill overlooking San Diego. And that cross is still there. I was just a few weeks ago out at UC San Diego and stopped by to see it. So what was the outcome on that case?
Well, yeah, that case has been litigated now for over 20 years.
Right.
And my last understanding of the case is that it's still in litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's attempts to continue to take that case down, or that cross down. But, you know, when you look at cases like this, I had the interesting opportunity. I was co-counsel at the U.S. Supreme Court on the McCreary County Ten Commandments case.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at that time, there was the McCreary case and the Van Orden case, McCreary being a plaques of the Ten Commandments on the walls of county courthouses in Kentucky.
Right.
The Van Orden case being a Ten Commandments monument on the state capitol grounds in Texas. The court said the monument was fine because it was old, but the plaques were not because of their history of kind of being put up. And so, you know, you look at these ideas, and I think there may be an acknowledgement by the court that in some of these areas of passive acknowledgments of religion, that if the court goes down the road of striking these things down, then there really is no logical stopping point. And, you know, memorials and specifically cross memorials would really have to come down all over the place.
Well, you'd have to be looking at Arlington National Cemetery.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if you did take it to the absurd point, I guess.
Well, I think it really would be. There's another case that we litigated with the Utah Highway Patrol, where they had put up crosses on the side of the road to honor their fallen
troopers, right?
And you know, those crosses would have to come down as well. And so, you get to that point of absurdity where any reference to religion and public life would have to come down. So, I think there's a practical understanding at the court that if they go too far with this, there's no logical stopping point.
Mm-hmm.
What I would hope is, though, is that there begins to be a theoretical understanding on the court that these types of acknowledgments of the role of religion in American life come nowhere close to an establishment of religion and a proper understanding of the Establishment Clause. That I'm a little fuzzy on, but that's my hope, is that the court will start moving in that theoretical direction.
And speaking of that theoretical direction, too, as one finding that I have come to through my own research and through a number of people who study religion through an economic lens, is that the pluralism, religious pluralism in the United States has really led to a vibrant spiritual market where all voices are being heard religiously and, you know, politically throughout the country. And that's been nothing but good for our country in many ways. It seems like, you know, freeing up churches to say what they want to is always an important thing. I should point out here as we finish up, we come close to conclusion, that although the Pulpit Initiative is making a case that pastors and churches should be allowed to speak on political matters and policy as they best see fit, that doesn't necessarily mean that they always should do that. Is that correct?
Well, that's true. I do think that there are pastors and churches who would agree that there are times that they shouldn't speak out. What I believe, and I think is a proper constitutional view of the issue, is that that's an issue for pastors and churches to decide for themselves. that when the government gets involved in the business of trying to decide when a church should or should not speak out on these particular issues, not only do you have a direct infringement on free speech and the free exercise of religion, but you have a real broad chilling effect that happens as a result. And so the government really needs to be hands-off when it comes to pastors speaking out on political issues from their pulpits.
And likewise, in my own research, I found that, you know, pastors, I agree that they should fully have that full freedom to do that, but that should always be exercised with great caution because, you know, pastors are primarily concerned with the spiritual well-being of their flock to begin with, and if they get too deep into the political environment, that could actually contaminate that mission in, to some respect. But
well, that's exactly right, and I do think, though, that that's a decision that can best be made by each pastor of each local church who best knows their own flock.
Right.
And that decision is really not one that's amenable to a top-down solution from the federal government. You know, it just when you have a one-size-fits-all of, you know, no one should be talking about this, then it really ignores those pastors and churches that do believe strongly that they have something to say and that they should speak out on some of these issues.
Absolutely. Freedom is absolutely just imperative here, and as my own research and a number of other people have said, that, you know, great nations flourish when there's a lot of freedom for everyone involved, from regular citizens to the clergy. Well, Eric, I want to thank you for joining us on Research on Religion today, and for those of you who are interested in commenting on this podcast or checking out the links to the ADL, you can visit our site at www.researchonreligion.org, and hope to have you back soon on the program. Eric, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.